Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Oh, good Mersh plug.
Hi.
Look at that.
Hi there. Yeah, thank you. Well, hi. Welcome to with Tom and Dave. Great to relax with just a cup of coffee.
And how's that coffee treating you, Dave?
It's good. This is my 12th Nespresso pod today, I think.
Yeah, I could see. I sensed that just then. Mm-hmm. I could hear the vibrations.
Yeah, so it's doing. I'm hoping it's doing its job right now.
It is. You seem utterly unintelligible.
That's good. That's good. Right.
We got you just at the right level.
Yeah. How are you
totally
doing?
Nonsensical.
You know what? Speaking of nonsensical, and today I was I realized just a little while ago I forgot I was supposed to go to the mummy press conference today, the Peruvian mummies.
What happened?
Jaime Maussan. Instead, I was on a conference call with you, and
that's terrible.
Yeah, I forgot.
Why are you
wasting
your time doing that?
I forgot to go to the. It was down at the Mondrian Hotel. Is that still called the Mondrian Hotel? I don't even remember.
It could be, but you know what? That mummy will still be around in a couple of days. I don't think they're going anywhere.
We'll see. I think that story is building. I'm afraid we're going to have to take it seriously. That's my worry.
That the
mummies are going to turn out to be real.
Oh boy, I don't know if I'm prepared for that.
Yeah,
but I believe you. I trust you.
Yeah, but speaking of,
you're my guide.
But we do have some an actual real person here today.
Yeah, this is a really
great story,
a big one. Yeah, this is I have been just kind of fascinated with the stories of interactions with UAPs and nuclear facilities, and this, however, goes kind of well beyond that. We have Mario Woods with us today, who was a staff sergeant in the security police in the U.S. Air Force from 1975 to about 1983. But in 1977, was a senior airman assigned to the Minuteman Missile Complex at Ellsworth Air Force Base in South Dakota. And the security police, I think, were assigned to a flight and a launch control facility. And Mario was at November 1 site. And each launch control facility was responsible for 10 Minuteman to 1.2 megaton missiles located in strategic locations to respond in case of, you know, alarm or emergencies. Ellsworth had 150 total missiles in South Dakota. The other bases in different states were the same. Mario Woods lived on site for 3 days, working 12-hour shifts, staffed with 6 security police, 4 officers, 1 site facility manager, 1 site cook, and 2 officers were underground at all times and worked the same shift as he did. This was a hardened facility, as all missile sites are, and the missile component was decommissioned, he believes, in 91. The Strategic Air Wing aircraft are still in use today. And just for a little context, during the Cold War, Ellsworth Air Force Base formed a key part of the so-called Northern Tier defense system, operating hundreds of nuclear-tipped Minuteman intercontinental ballistic missiles, as I just said. Mario is a witness, an experiencer in what is now known as the Ellsworth UFO case. We are really thrilled to have him here to share his story and Let's bring him in here on Really.
Hello, Mario.
I hope I did that okay, Mario.
Very good. Very good.
Sounded good on my end.
I think you're the only person, Tom, that's ever described that accurately. A launch control facility, because so many people think that it happened at Ellsworth on the base. They can't associate being assigned somewhere and being working in an area 65 miles away, which we all did, you know, from all South Dakota, all the way to the Wyoming state line, all the way to the North Dakota state line. That network.
Because these missile installations are huge tracts of land.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And mostly rented from ranchers for, I don't know what the payment was per se, as was the launch control facilities. They have literally been turned over to the, all these sites have been turned over to the land, original land owners. The fencing and the rock bed that sites were built up on to keep them out of depressions, you know, because it's a plains area and it floods. And I didn't say flooding, but, you know, it gets very wet, and these sites present a spot for them, say, at November 5 today. That rancher elected to use that facility to store his cattle's hay upon because the it's elevated up from ground level, and it's on a rock bed, so it keeps their hay and so forth dry. Now, there's also a metal building, a cattle processing building of some type on the site.
So the real winners in the nuclear proliferation are these ranchers.
I think so. I really do.
Yeah.
And they get the LCS. Now, there's one or two projects going on where people have gone out and hired contractors to start digging out the elevator shafts because the capsule and everything's still down there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if they pull the emergency releases on the evacuation tubes on the capsules themselves, but those tubes were fit. Those were escape areas for the two officers, and they backfilled with sand in the event that they had to evacuate the capsule, so nobody can ever use it again.
Yeah.
Oh wow. So just for a little context, where did you grow up? I mean, did you grow up in South Dakota? Were you?
Oh no. Okay. No, I entered the Air Force actually. From Gainesville, Florida. I had moved there and was living there, and I processed through the AFI station in Jacksonville, Florida. My home is Tampa, actually. Both my parents were there. They're both deceased. And spent probably 40 years of my life in Tampa and some in California. And we owned a restaurant in North Carolina with our aunt. And so we were traveling back and forth during the summers. I had a home up there. And after the passing in 73 of our father, I literally, you know, I'm 68, and guys of this age, we know we were raised a little bit differently. So you have a responsibility to your family, to my mother and my sister and my two younger brothers, one's deceased now, of support in any way possible. So I worked to help my mom as well as I could. And the pay was not very much going in the Air Force, but it was better than the alternatives. And, you know, you could work for a factory or whatever, but you didn't have the benefits or there was no travel involved or nothing. You know, I mean, that's one thing you got to say about all the services. You're going to see some parts of the world that you need to see. I mean, it's an expedition of life, you know, and I love expeditions. So, I spent most of my time in Florida, though, in Tampa.
Okay. And 75, you joined the Air Force in 75. Yeah. And are you stationed in South Dakota at that point, or has it started in Gainesville?
Well, I started out in basic training. Then let's see. Then you go through different technical training schools, like Camp Bullish was an old prisoner of war training camp, and then security police. You know, there's security, and then there's law enforcement. And security police are kind of like the ground pounders per se. Of the Air Force, whereas law enforcement maintain most of the base functions like bank, CBPO, or admin buildings, and responded to alarms, door alarms, area alarms, did safe checks and that type of thing, where we were the actual resource protectors, whether they be sensitive nuclear materials, uploaded aircraft, missile systems, whatever they were. So there was a little different job assignments there.
Mm-hmm. But if anything is actually going on awry out where the missiles are stored, that's when you guys get called.
Well, that's called a weapon storage area, what you just described. Well, these are actual missiles that are actually ready to go.
Yeah.
A push two buttons. No single person can launch any Minuteman or Titan or anything like that by themselves. It takes two people to launch. And anytime you're in an area where there are nuclear materials or sensitive nuclear materials, whether it be U.S. Department of Energy, or which I was a part of also, or Department of Defense, there's a two-man rule. There can never be one single person having access to any of those resources by themselves. It's always a two-man rule.
Mm-hmm. And each of the capsules, like where the launch officers are, they would each be responsible for how many missiles?
10.
So
each launch control facility had responsibility for 10 missiles.
And it was
I'm not sure what the overlap could be if something grave were to happen, but there are other ways in which controls can be granted to supervisory way upper level channels that could, you know, including the president, that to launch from Air Force One, they can override some of these things. But again, nobody can do it by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
What's your state of, it was the Cold War. How would you describe the security environment there? I mean, is it extreme high alert? Is it sort of things get kind of routine? We're in 1975, 77. I don't know. How would you describe the security environment? I mean, are you prepared at any minute for something to take place, or are you sort of just?
At all times. I mean, when you're on those sites, and even when you're at home, you know, you can be recalled in an instant. You know, back then, we had I don't know if you remember the American Indian movement, and I saw what Russell Means, and there was an FBI or two FBI agents that went to some reservation there in South Dakota, and one was killed, I believe, and it was a big uprising. They never presented any danger to us, and where I lived in Rapid City, there were several Indians that live right down the street from you, just as nice as guys you ever want to meet. But there were threats against Mount Rushmore and threats that they were going to try to take a site. Believe me, it would take a whole lot more than a shovel, a pick, and a sledgehammer to get into one of those facilities. Mm-hmm. It's just that simple. And of course, we would know, we would be there, and we're armed, and we'll do whatever it takes to prevent that from ever happening, including giving up our own lives.
Like prior to the incident we're going to discuss, which is pretty amazing, mm-hmm. Did you have other times when you were called out, whether like where security was really threatened, or where you felt like there was a dangerous situation that you had to go into, or were you mostly just staying prepared for the worst?
Well, we did facility checks on every single day that we were there, whether they be gate checks, fence line checks, lighting checks at night. We all, you know, everything pointed toward the missile system and its successful existence and launch. Let's just put it that mm-hmm. way. And we had one incident one time where we had some maintenance workers on a facility, and we had a camper alert team there. And these are guys that actually camp on the site in a camper, and they hook up electrically and everything right to the site, and they stay there while maintenance is doing, whether in a realignment or whatever kind of work pertains. But this one particular night, one security policeman chose to, instead of eating the prepared meals that are, you know, that they can cook in their accommodation there, their camper, there's two men there. There are these little retention ponds on some sites that are close by, and a northern goose landed in one of these ponds. So this airman first class, security policeman, he gets his M16. And you know it's going to go bad from here, right? Because you cannot discharge a weapon. You cannot replace a round. Those are M55 rounds. Steel tip rounds, you couldn't go buy them then, let's put it that way. He elects to walk off the site with his M16 and his parka and his flight pants. It's extremely cold. And he shoots this goose. Well, about 2 miles away from there, or just a little less, was the rancher's house that owned the property. So naturally, you know, you want these guys, those ranchers, on your side at all times. I don't care what's happening. they are armed better than we are. We've got fully automatic weapons. We've got backup. We've got helicopters coming. But they, those guys know, they know the lay of the land. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. So this guy jumps in his pickup truck well before we arrived. And he flies out there, hauls in his pickup truck, and he finds out what's going on. Now, the worst part was, by this time, wing security control had been contacted. Shots had been fired. This guy reported everything. Shots had been fired. This is back at Ellsworth now. That's where wing security control was located. And they're the overall security force monitoring everything we do. They're listening to all radio transmissions at all times. So they literally dispatched a helicopter with, I don't really know who all was on a helicopter to come to that site. But after he shot that goose, and the ranchers in route, I'm trying to put this sequence of events in mind now, he ran back to the camper, grabbed a broom because the goose was a little bit far from the bank and he couldn't reach it. And the goose wasn't dead. It was flipping around real hard. Oh, and his head was under the water. And he asked his partner to help him. I'm not sure if the partner did or not. It would have been bad if he did. But anyway, he goes out there and he's trying to get this goose and pull him because he's going to clean him and cook him.
Somewhere. I was going to say, man, that's supper.
I mean, come on. You know what that would look like? White feathers all over a rock-laden missile site. But anyway, that goose, I guess the round just went past him. All of a sudden, he popped his head up. The ranchers arriving, and the goose took off. The guy didn't even hit the goose.
So I was going to say, well, the worst thing would be if he actually missed the goose.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. He missed the goose took off. So by this time, we're getting called to go to the site. Yeah. So we're scrambling, grabbing stuff. You know, we stay ready, but I mean, we were like gone and got our safety briefing weapons and we were gone, you know?
Yeah.
We get out there and that rancher is there and this guy is so mad. I didn't even put my weapon on. His whole front area of his truck was laden with rifles and pistols.
Jeez. I mean,
God almighty, man. He didn't want me anywhere around it. He goes, I just talked to the guy. I'm a pretty good negotiator. And anyway, I talked with him for probably 30, 35 minutes. And all of a sudden you hear way in the background, you hear this helicopter coming. And I said, we've got help coming. I said, that's probably our base commander and our wing commander and everybody else on that helicopter. And he looked at me for a minute and he goes, you're lucky I don't shoot them down. I said, you don't want to do that.
Shit, wow.
I mean, that's what he said, you know.
That's an escalation. Wow.
He was really torqued off about that one goose, and it was on his property, and he didn't appreciate that. So you have to respect what they do. And I always – I did them favors a couple of times. I shouldn't have done it. I could have gotten in trouble. But using a front-end loader to get out to their cattle in the wintertime, and it was, mm-hmm. 8-9 foot of snow. I mean, literally – because you can't make a snowball there. It's so dry, it's like talcum powder. I don't know if you've ever been to the Dakotas, but in that area, it's just you grab a handful of snow and hit it, and it just blows away. You can't make a snowball.
Yeah. That's like
– So things did happen.
Like I was going to say, and that must have really shaken your faith in his marksmanship to have him – you would want him to have your back.
You know, I'm not a hunter of animals. You know, I was trained to – to hunt bad guys, if that were the case. And I don't mean that as any special way or nothing. That was just the police type duty in me, you know what you have to do and what, and why you're there. So, but, he was an avid hunter and he missed, so he had to live with that.
Yep.
Yeah. Nice,
he lost his career. I'm sure, I don't know what the after effects were, but they relieved him. It was a big 4-hour ordeal and they had to reassure the farmer and they did some relations with his family. I don't know what all happened, but it was not a good day.
Yeah. Right.
And, but then again, I guess we should move on to a more unusual day that you experienced.
Sure.
Well, yeah. If you can just take us to, and it is, it's a bit of a pivot tonally for sure. I know of your story. I know pieces of your story. I know I'm really just fascinated to hear it and for our audience to hear it. Where for you does it begin?
This particular night, I'm going to say it was around November 16th of 1977. And my normal partner, I was normally a team leader at November 1 on whatever shift I was on, day or night. And he had gone to North Carolina to be married. So anytime that happens, he took 30 days vacation. They send someone to from another area, like we had the 66th, 67th, and 68th areas, started at Wall, South Dakota, or down toward the Badlands, all the way up. You know, there were 800 security policemen on that base. So there was always ample vacation relief people. And they would have to come out and fill that position while we worked, or, you know, and form a team that we worked together for those 12-hour shifts in those 3 days. So this guy's name is Michael Johnson, a real light-skinned black guy. He told me, we had just met that day, that he was from Chicago, where his family lived there. He was a single guy. I was married at the time. And, you know, we just discussed a few things. He outranked me by 2 months that I recollect. So it made me the team member, which was fine because I knew where to go and how to get there. And he had no idea. He'd never been in a 68th area before. And on this particular night, I'll just start right out at about 9:15. I was up all day. And knowing that I was coming on at 6 p.m., I just didn't decide to take a nap. I think we got out there around 11 or 12 or something like that in the morning. And then the off-going shift, they go back in for their days off. And I just stayed up, and 6 o'clock we came on duty. So you get your code tables, you get your weapons issued to you, everything's ready for you. You know, you get your bag ready, you put it in the vehicle, and if it's extremely cold, a whole lot of snow or ice or black ice everywhere, vehicles are plugged in. That keeps the transmission or the radiator warm. They don't freeze in place, because we've had that happen. We've had tires freeze to the cement or the concrete.
Yeah, South Dakota, that's cold. That's winter.
I've seen 3-foot walls, 3-foot thick concrete walls crack from cold. And I don't know if it did it right then, or it was over a few year process, but I spent 3.5 years out there, and I've seen some extremely bad weather, and very deep snow. But so this particular night, I literally walked outside at probably 8:55, 9 p.m., and I smoked then. And of course, I ran probably 40 miles a week. I really didn't care, and I played tennis and everything. But I just happened to look up studying the stars, because, I mean, there you're over a mile high to start with, and there are times when you see the aurora borealis during the wintertime, and the stars just look as if you can just reach up in them and grab them. You know, and the Milky Way is just lit up. You know, I mean, it's just gorgeous. I never saw skies like that anywhere else on a coastal area that I lived. And on this particular night, honestly, I just looked to the east at about a 30-degree inclination to my right, and which would be back toward Ellsworth Air Force Base, which was about 55, 60 miles away. And I see this object. And I thought, honestly, I said, what the hell is that? I thought it was two B-52 bombers, which we support. I think they have Lancers there now. Yeah, they do. I just want to make sure I got that name right. But I thought it was two B-52 bombers, because they used to practice their sortie runs at night sometimes, you know, and they were only like 500 feet off the deck, you know, I mean, just, and two B-52 bombers are awesome aircraft. I didn't know that, you know, they could literally outturn many fighter aircraft. Their wings were flush 26 feet in either direction. Now think about that, B-52 bomber. Yeah, I mean, I was told that by a pilot that gave me a pair of gloves that I'm missing one of. But so I see this object, and if I held my hand out, because I tried to compare size, you know, because in tech school you're taught about aircraft, you know, what they are or what they could be, you know, by design or shape. And I held my hand out like straight like that, and it would cover the diameter of the light up. But if I did my fist like this, then it was larger than my fist. And I went, it's got to be two B-52 bombers together, right? Because they're following each other, and they'll break out like this or something, which they didn't do. I said, it can't be a helicopter, because we had a Bell or Super, maybe Black Hawks or something like that. which came out sometimes when there was so much snow that we couldn't come out by bus that we normally came in. So they would come out and pick us up by chopper. But it wasn't those kind of lights. And the luminosity or the intensity, the lumens of the light, now that I know what the word lumen means, then I didn't. You know, we had all incandescent stuff, you know. And this thing was just huge compared to anything I'd ever seen. But I watched it and it didn't seem to be really moving. It was just sitting to my east at about 30 degrees.
And I'm sorry, Mario, is it completely luminous or was there shape?
Yeah.
Could you discern a shape? Just utterly a huge light.
Completely round luminous. Mm-hmm. And that's why I thought I was looking at a spotlight, a big lamp of some big light of some kind, you know, mm-hmm. or maybe combined was throwing this light at me. I really wasn't sure. And it was probably around 7-8 miles, 9 miles away. And it was just the strangest, you know, the strangest light I think I'd ever looked at. So I smoked a cigarette and I looked at this thing and it wasn't moving. And I thought, well, I don't hear anything, you know, and sound travels, you know, in an area like that. I mean, these launch control facilities, fellas, are just in the middle of nowhere. Mm-hmm. The next closest town, well, we had Newell is, I think about 8.5-9 miles south of where we were. To the north would have been, well, that would have been north and west. That would have been Belle Fouche at about 40 miles away. Sturgis would have been behind me by about 50 miles, 30 miles, 30 miles. And to the east, I'm really not sure. But there are no cities around you. There's no large cities. And Newell had a population then of just 220 or 204 people, I think. Mm-hmm. It was on the entering and exiting town.
Yeah. But your immediate inclination is to try to figure out what normal thing could explain what you're seeing.
I couldn't make it out. So my buddy Bill Holloman, he was a flight security controller. He was a security policeman. He was just the highest ranking of us three. So you have a flight security controller, a team leader, which was Michael Johnson, outranked me by 2 months, and I was the team member. I just happened to be outside, and I've got all my weather gear on. I think I had long johns on and fatigues and everything. My parking stuff was inside. My bunny boots were inside. And so I thought, well, let me go tell Bill about this. And he was on the phone talking to his wife back in Rapid City. Bill's a North Carolina fella, and I really wish I'd get in touch with him today. But really great guy. Loved him to death. And I walked in and he was on the phone, as I said, and I said, Bill, I said, man, there's something out here to the east of us. I said, and I don't know what it is. I said, it's huge. It's a big old bright light. I said, I think it's B-52 bombers. I said, if it's helicopters, maybe they'll flash back at me. I said, can I flash it with the facility lights, which were either 12 or 14 large 2-foot cans on the roof and the perimeter of our facility. We're a hardened, fenced in facility, right? Every facility is the same way. Every facility had the same toggle switch to turn the dadgum lights off and on, all in the same location, all 15 sites, right? So I knew where all that was located, and he just looked at me and waved me off. And so that was permission to do so. So I just walked up, not even knowing if it was still out there yet. About 5 minutes had gone by, and I just flipped the lights off and on at it 3 or 4 times, just in no sequence, no SOS or anything like that. And I walked outside and I was looking at it, watching it. And I hadn't been out there maybe a minute, and all of a sudden it went off. It went on, it went off, went on, went off, went on. I went, okay, that's got to be a helicopter. Somebody sees me, because, you know, like I said, these sites are all standalone and there's nothing around them. There's no buildings. There's nothing but pure plain prairie land. Buffalo are out there, you know, seen them running. So I got excited. So I ran back inside and I said, well, that's really cool. And I got that idea. Of course, my father was a merchant seaman, and I got to sail with him a few times as a kid. And sometimes ships, you know, communicate like that, as we've all seen in war movies and all that stuff. I later worked for a shipping company and they out of Norway, and they do use lights at night out at sea to communicate sometimes. But anyway, So I said, I can't believe this thing. And I'm telling him, I said, you got to come see this. And he just waved me off. He was like, whatever.
And so your message, you were just, Mario, sorry, you were just saying, hey, what's up? Just kind of like, let's acknowledge each other.
That's all. Because, I mean, you know, I had done that plenty of times before, like the helicopters coming out on missile sites. Or, you know, even in training, you know, you can, back then we used F-4 Phantoms. And there were times when F-4s at different bases would fly, and you'd be at the end of the runway, and you'd either flash a light at them, or if they could see you or what, do this, and they would just go, they wave their wings at you.
Oh, that's cool. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. It's really cool, you know?
Yeah.
So helicopters the same way. So that's what I was looking for, and I got that response back. So I, you know, theoretically, I just said, well, that's just one of our aircraft, you know? I still hadn't heard anything. It hadn't moved, which was really curious because, you know, whatever speed it was flying at had to be coming directly toward me, but it wasn't getting any closer. So I did it again, and I told Michael Johnson, I said, you'd come out here and check something out. He wasn't really interested in it, the fact that there's a light out there, and I don't know what he thought, actually. I said, dude, you got to come out here and see this thing, man. I said, I don't know what it is, and maybe you can help me figure it out. And I said, I think it's B-52 bombers. So he didn't really say anything. He got up and he came outside, and I'd already been outside. And when I did, before I went out, I walked up, I flipped the lights again at it. And I got out there, and while he came out there, as he was approaching me, it went off, went on, went off, and went on. But when it went off the last time, it went off and stayed off for maybe 30 seconds, 25, 30 seconds. I'm just trying to recollect everything in my mind all the time. And it moved. Didn't get closer, but it moved north and kind of at an angle more north than it was east. So it kind of like vectored over this way. So it was more north toward Castle Rock is one place that's out there. It's a landmass. It looks like a big four column castle, flat top area. And he went, I said, man, what do you think that is? I don't know. He says, gotta be B-52s. Cause he knew what Ellsworth had. He'd been there a little bit longer than I had, you know, at the base itself. And, I said, you don't think it's a helicopter? He said, no, he just said, no. He goes, whatever, man, it's nothing. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, stay right there. I'm going to go flip these lights at it one more time. So I ran back inside. Now, mind you, you're only 20 feet outside the LCF door. Right. And, I ran inside. Bill Holloman still a phone. I said, man, come out here and see this thing. You got to see it. And he just looked up at me like I was getting on his nerves. I'll never forget it. He didn't think that the next morning, though. But anyway, I flipped the lights at it again. And when I got out there, Michael Johnson's still standing there. And, of course, it was there in the air. It was just further north. Not further away in distance, just moved more to the end.
Could you estimate mileage at this point in terms of distance?
7-8 miles, perhaps.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm assuming the size of my hand covering it or not covering it. I've done that there. There's some type of a calculation that you can make like that.
Yeah. And I'm assuming like civilian aircraft are not allowed in that space.
I don't think it's a, an area that's not allowed to be flown in.
No.
Most people just don't fly there. There's nothing to see.
There's nothing there. Yeah.
I guess. I don't know. Mount Rushmore, you can't fly over Mount Rushmore, I don't think. But, you know, the missile sites, I don't think that was protected airspace.
No. Oh, okay.
So as I did that, he all of a sudden a few seconds went by and it went out. It went out and it came back on in the same location. It went out and didn't come back on. So now that time's gone from, say, 5 to 9 to 9:15, 9:20. And that was, I said, well, I guess that's the end of it. You know, it went away from us. I was thinking maybe it turned and the light just was looking is in the front of it or whatever. That's what I thought. I really didn't think nothing else. Honestly, a UFO or I didn't think anything like that. I went back in kind of shaking my head and Michael Johnson just went back in there and sat down, and I walked in there to talk to Bill Holloman. He's still on the phone, so he's been on the phone now about 45 minutes.
It's hard to get your wife off the phone sometimes. Listen, I completely relate. I understand.
It cracked me up. It really did. But So I sat down, I started doing something, watching some TV. And back then we only had three channels, you know, and at midnight they would go off and you'd get that signal, and that, whatever that was at the time. And, so I'm really not sure what we did. I mean, I may have had a few books or something, or a book. And, I guess it was about 12:20 in the morning. And, 2.5 hours later, all of a sudden I hear the alarm phone go off in the flight security controller's office. And it's one of those phones where when it goes off, it has to be answered. It can't, it's not something that's not a regular, it's from the capsule crew downstairs. And Bill picked it up and, you know, he said, Sergeant Holloman. And of course the officer down there, there's two of them, said, we have a SIP 4 at November 5, which happens, November 5 is the closest launch facility to November control. And by the crow flies, just 5 to 7 miles away, you know, 6 to 7 miles away. And drive time is about 15 minutes. And it's actually back toward the town of Newell. So he does that. And then he hands the phone to Michael Johnson. You know, he gets a safety briefing, you know, the travel time and the security checks that have to be in place, you know, which we have security checks every 5 minutes while we're en route to an alarmed area. And the wing security control is made aware of this. So they're listening everything on the radio along with your flight security controller and the capsule crew is listening to you. So you have all these different avenues that are monitoring your progress as to what you're about to find or, you know, what the cause of the alarms are, basically. But so we got everything, threw our bags in the vehicle and weapons.
Mario, is this is this, how rare is something like this? Is it a once a week, twice a day, once a month?
No. I mean, a SIT 4, I don't, it doesn't happen that often. It's a 2-point alarm mechanism, and one's above ground and one's below ground. And it's something to be taken seriously. And there are worse type alarms or more serious alarms, but I don't think I ever responded to maybe but one of those. Okay. And I'll tell you about that. But so anyway, we got our briefing, got all of our stuff. Didn't really expect anything at all. And went out the gate, took a left. And all these roads are clay roads. They're maintained by the state. And you can go from east to west, from, you know, to all the way to Wyoming and back to wherever you want, wherever you came from across the state and north. And, so I think it was about 4.5 miles to Highway 79. So we went out, took a left, went down our next intersection, all clay intersection, took another left. There's no street lamps. There's nothing. This is pure dirt road in the middle of nowhere. As we're approaching the roadbed or Highway 79, which runs north and south, I just happened to look over to my right at about the 4 o'clock position. And I see the strangest glow. You know, prairie and plains area is very flat if you're on the plateau. There were no mountains or anything. I mean, the Black Hills are back toward Rapid City and a little bit south of that area. But I see this glow. It's doing like this off the ground or at a very low altitude, way over to where November 5 is. I mean, I could see it. So something was making that had never been there before, ever. In all my years out there, I'd never seen anything like that. And I said, Michael, as we went, got on the road and turned right, which is Highway 79 and Missile Road, it's called, today, I said, you see that over there? I said, that's that object. He just said, whatever, man. I think he was torqued with me or scared. I really think that he was afraid. I was kind of excited, but I was kind of anxious about it also, not knowing what could cause that. And then thinking the other thing was something bad has happened on that site. There's a release or something, you know, because, you know, there's not a whole lot on that that can do. There's not a whole lot at that site that can do what I was just describing as far as glowing and pulsing. It would just be a boom. It would just be an implosion. If worst case scenario, unless it's a fuel explosion, and those were solid fuel rockets. But so anyway, it's about 5.5, 6 miles down to the first stop sign in Newell, which was, and you turn right. That was Orman, O-R-M-A-N Road. You can look it up on Google Earth. That same house is sitting right there on the corner. I was out there in 2021 doing with Discovery Plus. And it was just, it was unbelievable being back there after all these years. And of course, as we went down the hill in 79, you lose sight of that pulsation. You know, we went down below it, I guess, as to where, you know, at so you could see it visually. So we turned right at the stop sign, and then the road went out about a mile and a half, and it drops back off onto clay again. And when it doglegs to the left, and I paid real close attention to that when we were out there riding up on it again, because I literally lost my breath on that road going in 2021. I literally just, it got me really bad. And when we turned that dogleg to that left, this object was sitting in the atmosphere maybe 10 feet off the ground, directly on top of that blast door of November 5. And I've used this as a comparison because it's the only thing that I know a lot of people can relate to. It was the size of a Walmart building. Mm-hmm. No noise. There were no leading edges. There were no thrusters. There's no cockpit. There's no wings, no tail section. It is just a glowing mass, like a plasma ball, I guess, or something on top of the structure itself.
Mm-hmm. It was spherical.
That was electric. Yeah, complete spherical, red, orange, white, rotating, kind of like, I don't want to say flames, but like an electrical discharge on the entire outer shell of this thing. Mm-hmm. And we pulled up right at the cattle gate, which was about 60 feet from that front gate at a 45 degree angle. You have one of the drawings there where you can see our vehicle at the end. And now that was our, and I've said this before, that was our big tactical move. So you can imagine being overwhelmed by something that you're visually coming into contact with that you have no idea what it is. When you see two aircraft carriers in the atmosphere, literally 10 feet off the ground, the size of that mm-hmm. just is... there's no words to describe it.
Yeah, well, we got an image of.
Oh, look at that!
A young, handsome
young soldier. Look at that guy.
Yeah, that was young. All right. I was 23 years old when this happened, by the way, and wow. Rocked my world pretty good. But that right there is looking down, and that octagon shaped thing in the middle would be the missile silo blast door, and that little ladder thing on the rear end of it is the cattle is the rail system for when that door is blown off. It trips that door up and over that fence and blows it quite a bit, and that's what I would compare the size of this thing mm-hmm. you know, in relationship to that missile site. And this is just totally in my judgment, no one else's. I drew the picture or drew the drawing myself.
And your truck was to the south here at the bottom of the fence,
right? Oh, okay, there. And
so you're very close to this thing.
Yeah, I'd say 60 feet. Actually, the thing about it was this outer ring, the outer diameter of this was almost directly over our heads. It was just that large, and it's hard to draw that. And it's hard to relay that to people. But
was there a sound associated with it?
No, just a displacement of air and electricity in the air. Mm-hmm. And that's looking at it from the street view. And those three little things in the missile site are one component of the alarm system, which put like a 10-foot umbrella over top of that site in radio waves. And if they're encroached upon or broken, you know, like a bird flying through or an owl or something like that, which has happened, it would alarm. But that was a different situation, just different situation. Yeah.
So your perspective also, I notice in the drawing, I mean, this is the height of it is.
Oh, it's gargantuan.
So it's not a sort of flat sphere so much. Yeah. It's a giant,
a complete round sphere. That's absolutely huge.
It looks kind of like the sphere in Las Vegas. It's about that size. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The thing about it that's really perplexing, I'll go into this drawing in a moment. As soon as we arrived, this light hits, or I don't know if we rode into it or it hit us all of a sudden, the interior of our vehicle, it was like everything was in slow motion. I could see dust particles. I always have that mind where I can take a mental picture of something and recall it forever. I do it every birthday. I try to see something and I try to remember it. And I do. I've always had that kind of memory. But I could see dust particles on Michael Johnson's steering wheel. He was operating the vehicle. I was the passenger. I could see dust in the vents of that F-154 pickup truck, which is a dark blue, and it had a light blue, like vinyl interior to it. Black floor mats, our weapons rack standing right behind us, and our radio, our Motorola radio hanging on the dashboard. I could see all this stuff plainer than any vision I've ever had of being inside of a vehicle. And how can you describe a vehicle differently when you get in it? In this light, it allowed you to see more than I've ever seen before. The second thing about this is that the atmosphere was just removed and I couldn't breathe. I was an avid runner. I probably, honestly, with tennis and much as I worked out, I probably ran 40, 50 miles a week and was in extremely good condition, as was Michael Johnson. And we couldn't breathe. I rolled the window down and I had to ask for relief. Now, where did a thought like that come from? Where did that even come from?
I'm sorry, Mario. Was it you were aware this was happening too versus just a fear? I mean, a very natural response of maybe just you felt this thing was drawing the atmosphere away from you or the oxygen.
Oh, there's no doubt. I felt as if I was being pulled up into the back glass of that single cab F-150. It was like a vacuum. It wasn't just not being able to breathe. It was like there was a vacuum being exerted in the interior of that vehicle.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And all the visual acuity was just completely enhanced. And like, it was as if slow motion was just all over me or something. I remember particles floating through the cab of that truck, which were dust particles, you know, just glistening. I can't do that today. I can't go get my vehicle and see that today. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if it was the luminosity of the light itself. I don't know if it was the vacuum. I don't know what the heck it was. Mm-hmm. And I knew I had to ask for help from whatever that was. And I rolled that window down, grabbed my, not Maglite, but a 3-cell aluminum black.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flashlight, Maglites, I've been corrected about this, didn't come out till 79. Well, this was 1977. Mm-hmm. Somebody was making black aluminum flashlights, and I had one, and it was a prized possession because that green plastic thing they issue to you with the curved neck like this with 2 D-cell batteries in it is about worthless. I mean, really, for a flashlight. And I rolled that window down, reached up on that Western mirror, and without a glove on this hand, and I had a mitten on this hand, and I pulled myself up on that windowsill of that vehicle. I was too afraid to step. I was 6 foot, 1.5, 220 pounds and hard as a rock, and I was afraid to step out of the vehicle. I was literally afraid. There was never any thought of firing upon it or anything like that. There was not a thought of running. It was just something that I had to flash this light at this thing. And I pulled myself out and I grabbed onto the mirror to do so. And then I put my left hand on top of the blue bubble. And then I reached up and I flashed this imitation mag light a couple of times at that craft. Now, as bright as that thing was and as large as it was, what were the chances that whoever's looking down would, you know, or whatever, would see that? As soon as I did that, I remember slithering back down in my seat, grabbing my M16, putting it between my legs. I don't know where my flashlight went. I roll the window up because now I'm afraid of what I might see. That thought just went right. You can't stop water flowing, you know. It's going to get through sooner or later. I roll that window up. I looked at Michael Johnson, and he was bathed in this blue light that is indescribable. Blue, white, silver light, just bathed in it. And he was locked onto that steering wheel like he had, he's on that steering wheel like it was for his life or something. And I said, Michael, it's going to be okay now. I said, you can breathe now. And I, where did that come from out of me? I don't know. It's as if this object popped in front of our windshield, a round looking ball that I want to say it was about six times the size of a beach ball, but it had these vents on it, and this thing just shot down on top of our hood and just literally danced around the front of the vehicle. And I'm just looking at it thinking, what is that? There was no word of or frequent use of drone or anything like that back then. Mm-hmm. And I remember the vents in this. I remember the vents because I said, how is that moving around like that? And it was honestly as if and gone just that fast. But it was huge. And it was black, and I thought maybe it was going to hit our vehicle, but it didn't. It just was like observing or something.
And go ahead, Dave.
I was just going to say, you didn't see it. Like, did you see it emerge from any place, or did it?
No. Remember now, the craft on Michael Johnson's left, mm-hmm. and we're at this precarious position here, using the vehicle for a defensive position.
Yeah,
makes me feel so foolish when I say that. You know, that's our go-to defensive position. That's what we were trained to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I still had to walk from the vehicle to go to that gate and unlock it and then call on radio what's causing this alarm after I did a whole bunch of searching on that site above ground and below ground. That never happened. Yeah. So this thing goes away. I don't know where it went. It was there maybe 30 seconds, maybe. And then this permeating smell of ammonia, like shrimp in a bad cooler or something, I get this smell just hits me. I don't know where it's coming from. And I don't know what I said about it to Michael Johnson because he didn't speak at all. He was just frozen to the steering wheel. And you have to understand that. I've never seen a human being that's locked up like that. There was no emotion. There was no anything. His eyes were wide open. And I was just trying to worry about myself at that point. I mean, really, we were both safe in a vehicle, going through what we were going through. But that smell was almost, it really bothered me. And I can't eat a Gulf shrimp today because of it, because it smells like it. It would just throw me right there, you know. And there's many things that happened to me that relate directly to that night today. I got extremely, I don't know if you want to call it sleepy or just unable to do anything else. I wasn't going to run. I wasn't going to get out of the vehicle. And I said, I thought I couldn't hold my head up. I said, I thought I was passing out mm-hmm. with the window up. And as I was like into this tunnel vision now, or feeling like I was in tunnel vision, I had my beret on my head, my M16 to my legs, as I was, whatever I was doing as far as going out, I just looked to my right and I see these shadowy figures. And now they're on my right. The craft or that thing is on the left, you know, still, you know, 80 feet away or so, you know, over top of the site. I didn't associate anything with that, but there was still something on my right that was pulsating. And I don't know what that was, whether it was a craft or what another one that was, I don't know. And I see three small figures and one tall figure. And they're probably 20 foot away from me, and they're coming toward me. Now, I can't say that they were walking, but their bodies were just moving all as one just toward me. And the one on the right, he had this, they had uniforms on. The one on the right had this thing in his belt. That's what I call it, it's a belt. And it had a yellow tip on it that just glowed, just, and it got my attention. And I was like, what is that? And then what I picked up on next was the tall one in the middle behind these three. It had something here that was large, and it was glowing that same color. And I just remember closing my eyes, and that's the last thing that I saw.
And I think we have your sketch of what these beings look like. Maybe bring that up.
Their color was really strange too, because it wasn't a purple, it wasn't a gray, but there was a tint of a blue tint to them. In the what I could see as far as flesh would be. And of course their heads were shaped a little bit differently than that. I'm not a very good artist, but that I couldn't get any more. I should have been three of them, and
There's the object in his belt that you were discussing there.
Correct. On the top. Yeah. Right there on the, on that side. This guy, he had that on his chest. I tried drawing this thing about 15 times where I settled for that. And I don't know. That's just the thought that came into my mind.
How would you characterize your thoughts while this is taking place? And can you give us an idea of how much time between, in your estimation, was between arriving at the gate, the object, and then these figures? How much time was that? And just, are you able to process at all what you're seeing, or characterize it?
Well, we departed the site right around 12:30 p.m. So that travel time was about 12 to 15 minutes. So that puts us at what, 12:42, 12:45, something like that. And then all this transpired. And then and it was just an immediate, like, fast forward of all the things I just described to you that happened in a few minutes.
Yeah. Okay.
Immediately upon stopping that vehicle, it all just took place. And my thoughts were not, how should I say this? I wasn't in a survival mode, but I've never probably been more aware in my life, in my own body, mm-hmm. to the point where I don't really have descriptions for that.
Did you?
Michael Johnson, I can't speak for, because he never uttered a word. I just told him, when I dropped back in out of that window, I said, it's going to be okay now. You can breathe. Now, where did that thought? And I have to say these things because, you know, it's hard to talk to people about this.
Yeah.
People that are close to me that know me, you know, I'm not I just try to state the facts. You know, I don't try to get emotional about it anymore. I just try to say what I remember, and I've written this thing down a million times.
When these beings are approaching you, I mean, is it in your mind? Are you thinking this? I'm seeing beings from somewhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah. You were.
Yeah. There's coming and there's nothing. They're coming and I can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
And I don't think I could raise an arm or a leg.
Do you think the ammonia smell was related to the beings?
Absolutely. Yes.
Because that's really interesting, because I don't know if you, I know there's the Virginia, UFO case where there was two beings that were actually a ship crashed, and two beings were seen in this village, and these young girls described them as having an overwhelming and noxious ammonia smell coming from them.
It is. And it's, you know, once it permeates your nostrils, when I was sitting in that commander's office hours later, I was still smelling it. But of course, I didn't tell them that. And I'll tell you about that when we get to it. But I don't know how, what the duration was when I passed out. That's the last thing I remember.
Yeah.
There.
And that's as they are. How close are they to you when you pass out?
20 feet, 20 feet and approaching.
Yeah.
Maybe a little less.
Wow.
But they weren't coming fast, and they weren't walking as humans do.
Yeah,
you know, same. And you think that somebody smaller is going to be taking a lot of steps, right? I never saw a leg move.
Yeah, just sort of gliding
and,
out.
And I never saw a head go up and down. It was just a right at you. And there was nothing I could do, nothing I would do to stop it.
Yeah,
I knew my door was locked and my window was up. Yeah. Like that would defeat them, right?
And
that
you,
would
defeat. And you had your weapon, but that was not a thought that crossed your mind.
No, that part never never even crossed my mind to do something like that. You know, boy, that would have been a hello, how you doing, huh? Open up with an N16.
Yeah, well,
pretty foolish, you know.
Be one thing if it was a goose.
Yeah,
but. Yeah, but that would be that I needed to eat something, so.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, no, there was no cause for self-defense. And, yeah. You know, I don't know how other people would have taken that, but I just didn't feel, that threat from my life.
Yeah. And then
I honestly don't know what my mind was doing at that particular time.
And then when you pass out, what's the next thing that you're aware of?
I opened my eyes, sitting in the same position, in the same parka, in the same flight pants, in the same bunny boots, my M16 right here in my hand, and I look up and it's total darkness. And I go, I said, Michael, where's November 5?
Yeah.
Really, I said, where's the lights? Because each facility has lights on it, you know, ample lights. I said, what happened November 5? Where are we? He didn't answer. He's still locked on his steering wheel.
Still frozen.
And so I reached out, pushed him in the cheek. I pushed him in the arm. I said, hey, man, what's wrong with you? Come on, man. Wake up. And his eyes are wide awake. He's breathing. I check his pulse. He's warm. I said, what is wrong with you, dude? I couldn't get nothing out of him. I don't remember if the vehicle was running or it was off at this time. So I just reached up and I unlocked the door. The door was locked. And I popped that handle. And I stepped out, still looking his way. And I put one foot on the ground. And I stepped in mud. Now, the temperature was between 9 and 13 degrees. We had had a blizzard the week before, so there was snow and ice everywhere. And I said, where in the hell am I? Michael, where are we? And I couldn't figure out the mud deal because all the ground was frozen. And I saw this white wall, and this white wall's next to me about 6-7 feet away. And it didn't go up straight up like a 90 degree. It was at a slant. And I didn't know what that was. That's why I related it to a wall. And when I got out and looked around, when I got out and put both feet on the ground and looked, you know, left and right, it was as far as I could see both ways. And I went, and I kept saying, Michael, wake up, man. Where are we? How did we get here? I just kept repeating that to him. I tried to pull his hands off the steering wheel. No go, man. He was like, I thought, how can you're not cramping up? You know, you've been holding on that steering wheel since all this happened. How can you do that? Of course, he wasn't answering or anything like that. And in the middle of all that, the radio cracked alive and it said, WSC to November 1, what's your location? And I said, are you going to get that? Thinking that would jar him out of whatever he was in. Have you ever seen a human being lock up like that? Either of you?
No, never.
I've not seen one since. That's the only time that's ever happened to me. I hope I never see it again because I think we'll have some visitors close by or something. I don't know.
I mean, I've seen a grand mall seizure, but that's clearly a grand mall seizure. You know, I mean, I haven't seen, but it's not just frozen like that. No.
So I picked that microphone up and I said, Senior Airman Woods, WSC. I said, I don't know where we are. And he said, do you need medical help? And I told him, I said, my team leader, Michael Johnson, Senior Airman Michael Johnson, I said, he is unresponsive to all my attempts to get him to speak to me or anything like that. I said, I don't know where we are. Now, they knew we were at November 5, right? Mm-hmm. Or supposed to be at November 5.
Yeah.
And he says, Senior Woods, I want you. Now, well, he asked me if he's breathing, if he's doing this. Does he have a pulse? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. The whole nine yards. And everybody's listening by this point. I think all the capsule crews are listening within the 68th, maybe the other areas also. They've already got three security police backup alert teams and one primary looking for us. So that's six security policemen there looking for us. And there, he goes, I need you to make 1 minute security checks because we're trying to triangulate your location. We're going to triangulate your location. And I said, yes, sir. So I was doing what he was doing the whole time. I'm trying to wake up Michael Johnson, trying to get him to do something, trying to move him.
So they knew, you weren't where you were supposed to be.
I don't really think so. They were trying to triangulate where we were.
Are they triangulating off your radio signal?
Yes. Yeah. And how they do that, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I honestly don't know how they do that. I've never done it before. I remember something in tech school about it, but I didn't pay close attention to that, never thinking I'd have to have it or be one in charge of having to do it, you know? All I had to do was simply key my radio and talk for a second, and that would send a signal that they could somehow do what they did. So I step out of the vehicle, and it is pure mud around me, and I still can't figure out what this is, this white wall at this 45-degree angle is. And I'm talking to myself, literally, and I just can't figure out what's happening. I get my flashlight, and I shine it at Michael Johnson, and I'm just trying to look around and see things. And I thought, wait a minute, where is this place? And I look at my watch, and it's after 6 a.m. The sun's coming up. It's getting bright in the east, from the east.
Jesus.
That's what got my attention to look at my watch. It started getting brighter. And I went, oh, my God. So we had 5 hours of missing time.
Mm-hmm.
And about 40 minutes later, Michael Johnson's still the same condition, still the same condition.
Yeah.
I see headlights coming down this dirt road. We were behind the Newell Lake Reservoir Dam. And if you pull up that map right there, the whole from November 1, November 5, the Newell Lake Reservoir Dam is about 21 miles. Mm-hmm. But where we were from November 5 to this Newell Lake Reservoir Dam was about 9.5 miles from where November 5 is located.
Jesus.
And how we got from November 5 to Newell Lake Reservoir Dam, I have no recollection of and cannot tell you.
Mm-hmm.
The first person to pull up was a Sergeant Garza, and he was one of the response team people. He stopped about 60 feet short of us. And I walked around the vehicle and went out to meet him. And he said, just stay right there, Mario. He says, we're here to escort you to November control. And I said, man, I said, okay. I said, can you tell me what happened? He said, I can't talk to you about it. And he came from another site. Might have been Lima or one of those. I'm not sure which one. He was in my flight, though. So he was in the 68th. And then there were two other backup alert teams that were sent from other sister flights. That pulled up also when he found us.
Did that strike you as an odd response?
What, which one? But
his response of like, we can't tell, you know,
I can't tell you where you are. Yeah.
Right. I can't talk to you about any of it. I'm just here to escort you to November 1. That's what I'm here to do. And I said, well, I need help with Michael Johnson because he obviously can't drive. He can't talk. He's not doing anything. I can't get him to speak or utter a word or unlock him from that steering wheel. You would not believe the force that it took to pull that man's hands off that blue plastic steering wheel of that F-154 truck.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I thought I was going to break his fingers.
Yeah,
it wasn't something just like this. I mean, he was locked into this thing
for more than 5 hours.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Every time I saw him, that's the position he was in.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what happened in interim in those 5 hours. But we finally I'd unbelted him. We got him out. We zipped him over to the other side, seat-belted him in, and he just had his hands in his lap, just head hanging like this, eyes wide open. Never closed his eyes. I'm not even sure if he was blinking. But he was breathing, and he was warm, and he seemed to be – he was a human, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it wasn't but maybe a 15-minute ride to November control. And once we got there and everybody kind of broke off, the sister flight guys, they went elsewhere, I'm pretty sure. And, of course, the two on-duty officers that were on duty when we were dispatched, they were waiting on us. My flight chief, Master Sergeant Gray, Tech Sergeant Hawkins, Bill Holloman, the Staff Sergeant, Flight Security Controller, the facility manager, the guys that were on duty, they were there. So as soon as we pulled up, they just, you know, came to the vehicle right away. We pulled right up in front, you know, and everybody was asking questions and just unbelievable. I said, got to have help with Michael Johnson. I don't know what's going on with him. You know, I've never seen anybody like that. So they separated us. They took me in the day room and they literally put him, put his arms over their shoulders and they carried him to the back. And I guess they got water in him or whatever they could, but they didn't get him to speak either. Mm-hmm. So I answered questions honestly for two and a half hours to all, and they were just berating me from every direction. And I kept telling them, I told Bill Holloman, I said, man, that was the object that I was telling you about last night.
Right.
He honestly didn't want to comment about that. Mm-hmm. I guess it, because it put him in it, you know, in some right. way, but that's okay. I didn't mind that a bit, but,
did you perceive, I mean, for yourself, did you hesitate to share any details? Were you worried about sharing any of the details or were you just so overwhelmed? You're just, this is what happened.
I shared the craft and what we saw and how I didn't know where we got to and what was going on with Michael Johnson. I shared the size of the craft and they all, you know, just looked at me like, oh, he's lost his damn mind, you know. Literally, I did not say anything concerning what I saw out my right window.
If I had done that,
you know, we were members at that time, and it's still carried out today, of the personal reliability program in the nuclear program. So had I stated those things, I would have been put out immediately or put in a general career field, you know, in a supply room somewhere or something like that, or behind a desk or something. So I never relayed, you know, what I saw or the beings that I saw outside that vehicle to them, or even when I got to the base, which I was escorted there. But after, honestly, about two and a half hours, they gave everybody water and stuff except me. You know, I'm about to die. I'm parched, you know. And I told Sergeant Gray, I said, I need to go to the bathroom, you know. And it was almost as they didn't want to let me out of their sight. Honestly, I felt that way. I just felt as if they wanted me right under their thumb at all times, because at least I was coherent where my partner was wiped out, you know. Mm-hmm. And I went to the restroom and I didn't have to use it. I just went in there. I got something to drink first and I went in there and I opened up the stall door and I went and I just sat down on the toilet and closed the door. Those same stalls are still there today in that launch control facility. I was there, but, and boy, did it bring back the memories. And, I was sitting there, Dave, and all of a sudden my hearing kind of went a little strange. And then my eyesight, it went like super bright. Kind of like when a doctor dilates your eyes or something like that, you know, how you're really bothered by the light. It was something like that. And this ringing, this incessant ringing that just, I mean, it just got my full undivided attention. And this thought came upon me that I was going to leave my body. And I had a clear path, a way in which I could do that. And I couldn't give myself over to doing it, if that's the way to describe it.
Yeah.
I closed my eyes and I literally felt as if I was moving down through my body and I was leaving through my feet.
Yeah.
Where does that come from? I've read everything I can read about this, you know. I honestly felt that I had control over leaving my body. And I was going to do it whether I wanted to or not. It just seemed like I thought, well, maybe, I guess I'm dying. Mm-hmm. Maybe, I guess I'm dying. And I thought about everything in a flash, all my life, everything just flashed, you know, and somehow or another, and I feel that I'm down in here somewhere fighting whatever it is. I open my eyes thinking that would make a difference. And I see four little furry feet, though they weren't little, go by the bottom of the stall door. And behind them were two Cochrane shiny police boots. There was a drug dog and his handler. Mm-hmm. So they had a drug dog and a handler out there. And a guy knew me. I can't recall his name today. Or maybe we'd play tennis together or ping pong. I'm really not sure. And he says, "Hey, Mario, you okay in there?" And I said, yeah, I think so. You know, it's the way I responded. I said, I said, my ditty bag, my hawk bag is out there in the day room. He says, I already searched that. He goes, "You're good. I just came to check on you." I guess they want to see if I was doing something. I don't really know. Mm-hmm. And I told him, "I'm glad you came in here." I didn't tell him why. And so he walked out and I opened up the stall door and I went to the sink and I just splashed myself and wet myself thinking where all my vision was back to normal. I didn't have the ringing anymore. And
you felt solidly in your body at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, what was that? And I was afraid, you know, I was afraid of that. I didn't want that feeling to ever come back to me again.
Mm-hmm. Did it feel like your thoughts or something else's thoughts?
I don't know. You know, I mean, the thoughts of leaving.
Yeah. Just the awareness.
Honestly, it was presented to me
as an option.
That's the way it came upon me. And then as soon as I said that in my mind, the hearing screaming and then the vision changed and everything just started to go, you know, differently. I mean, everything, I perceived everything differently.
Yeah. Was any part of you just tempted to check it out, to give in to this impulse?
Well, I thought that's what I was doing and I chickened out.
Yeah.
I literally, like I said, I felt as if I was down here and I really didn't want to die.
Yeah.
You know, but I wasn't sure if I was or wasn't. I didn't.
Yeah. Or if there'd be a way back from this. Yeah.
Right. How do you, and then if you do get out, how do you come back or do you?
Mm-hmm.
Where do you go? You know, and I wasn't ready for any of that yet.
Wow. I don't blame you.
But so I literally wet my whole self down and I looked like hell when I walked out of that bathroom. But I wish I could have just got into a shower, but I wasn't allowed to at that particular point. And I came back out of the day room and matter of fact, Master Sergeant Gray said, "Well, did you take a bath in there?" I said, I told him I wish I could have. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Well, the squadron commander wants you in his office, so we're going to go there." And I said, "What about Michael Johnson?" And I said, "Don't worry about him. We've got him. He's fine." I said, "Well, I'd like to talk to him." He said, "That'll be a later time." He wasn't fine. He wasn't fine at all. He hadn't spoken anything back there in those rooms or in that room. And I got my stuff and weapon and everything, and they didn't relieve me of my weapon. That's what unidentified said. They were relieved of their weapons. We were never relieved of our weapons. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why that guy had to say that. But I got in a vehicle with him, another F-150, and back toward the base we went. It was about an hour and 10-minute ride to Ellsworth. Went in through the back gate at Box Elder. And went to the SATAF building, which was our headquarters building, and had to do the formal report in where you go up and you knock on the door and everything where everybody stands behind you, walk into the room, salute, report who you are, what you are, the whole nine yards. Ralph Eastbreaker was a colonel and a Fulbert colonel, and that was my commander. And he didn't ask me to sit down. I stood there at parade rest when he told me to for probably the first 30 minutes. And in that room was my flight chief, Sergeant Gray, the deputy base commander, Colonel Spraker, a man in a suit, a gray tweed kind of suit with a hat, but he had the hat under his shoulder. So I thought maybe he was something military or OSI or something. Then there was a captain, Jack Green. Is that right? Jack Green. And Rick Doty.
Rick Doty?
Yep.
The CIA officer?
Was, no, he, OSI.
No, OSI, yeah, OSI. Yeah. Rick, yeah. That Rick yeah. Doty.
Yeah, Rick Doty. Agent Jack Reed, not Green. I stand. Special Agent Jack Reed. He was a captain in charge of my investigation. And he died a few years ago. But Rick Doty sent me this. And we've talked several times on the phone, and we just had an offer to do a roundtable in Roswell that I don't know, the producer kind of fell through on. So I don't know what's happening with that. I won't worry about it. But Rick's a good guy. He's been through, he's done a lot of stuff.
For the, for those of us who, because I mean, it sounds familiar to me, but it, for the audience who doesn't, what, just a brief Rick Doty background?
Yeah, well, he was the subject of a documentary called Mirage Man.
Mirage Man, correct.
That was about intelligence officers who were assigned to disinformation campaign.
Correct.
Around the subject mm-hmm. of UFOs, and also to protect, top secret. What would we call it?
Communications and documents.
And documents and flights, and also flight developing technologies.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And he was also linked. I'm forgetting the name of the gentleman who lived near a base that witnessed some craft flying around. And I know that he was, eventually he was convinced that they convinced him that he was seeing UFOs.
Oh, really?
And, and he actually had a lot of mental health issues as a result of it. But that's the story. Those are the stories I know about Rick Doty.
Mario,
but he's definitely a guy who's been around the scene in this world quite a bit.
I outranked him at the time. He was very young. He was younger than I was at the time. But I remembered his face. And once again, that memory and that picture, I never forgot that face. I don't know why I looked at him and I never forgot his face. And the first time I saw him, on Ancient Aliens or whatever it was I saw, and I went, I know that guy. He was at my debriefing that morning. So I paint that date as November 16th, and it was just a little bit before Thanksgiving because I was going to be off, and I was excited because I was a newly wedded dude, you know. And but I never forgot him. And, you know, we've talked several times. I've got his number, and we communicate at any moment in time. And, then after that was the big disinformation campaign where, we had somebody saw something, it was an owl on the side or something. Somebody shot some rounds at it. And it really tried to take away from everything because I was never sent back to November Control. I was sent to Kilo Control, which is the alternate command post over all the missile areas, the 66, 67, 68, in case something happened at Ellsworth where Wing Security Control could not do what their job was. And I was always under the scrutiny of direct supervision until I got my assignment to Korea, not even 8 months later. Mm-hmm. And that should have been.
But you were never at any point relieved of duty. You were just shifted to another part of the missile command.
Mm-hmm. No.
Like how many miles, where you were shifted off, how many miles would that have been from November flight?
Ask that again. What is it now?
Like when they shifted you, you said you went to what was it, Kilo?
Kilo, yeah.
Like how far away would that be?
That was right next. We were at November, just above Newell, South Dakota. And then Kilo Control was on the other side of Belle Fourche, almost to the Wyoming border.
Yeah.
So it was the same at 68th area. It was just not November Control. Yeah. Now it was under the direct influence of supervisory personnel, and the OIC, officer in command of our flight, at mm-hmm. Kilo Control.
So
that way, you know, you're always with, matter of fact, and I was a team member there because everybody they put me with outranked me at that particular time.
See, Rizzi,
did anyone ever confirm any of the details of your story independent? Like, did anyone say, we believe you? Or did anyone ever say, yes, someone else saw this? Or were you really left in this vacuum of information of what their feelings were about your story?
That would be a two-pronged answer for me to do for you. And what I'll do is say this. Unbeknownst to me, and I only discovered this, I tell you what, let me go back to the interview in Colonel Straker's office to start with, and I will get to absolutely that. So of course I was asked everything, you know, what I saw, how I saw. They laughed at me when I told them the size of the craft, you know, and
you've been interrogated for hours at this point before going to the colonel's office.
Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely. You know, yes, sir. I don't even think the water had dried because it was on my fatigues and in my long johns. You know, I had on long johns also. So I'm just disheveled, you know. I mean, I felt that way. And so I relay everything and nobody really says anything. And all the OSI guys are sitting over here on my left and I'm standing here right after probably an hour of being there. He allowed me to sit down in front of him in a chair and discuss the rest of it, answer any questions. At no point. And I told him everything, you know, concerning facility lights, you know, what I saw outside that window, what I did with the flashlight, everything that went on, the condition of my Michael Johnson, how he acted, what he didn't do, the smell. I didn't relay what that came from. I did everything. I said everything except what I saw out that window. Mm-hmm. And I was still worried up to that point if I was going to have a job in a week. I'd only been out one day. See, and my wife would be used to me staying. I would have been gone 3 days and come in the morning of the fourth day. So when I was allowed to contact her way, way later that day, she was like, what happened? Well, of course, I couldn't speak about it. And I'll tell you that, right, too. But I discussed everything with them right then and there and didn't know how long that would be continuing conversations. I really didn't know. But they didn't like the subject matter. Let me just say that real quick. And there had been other stories of other things occurring. Two security policemen in the missile field. One was down by the Badlands. And these guys were found almost naked, weapons strewn in two different locations away from their vehicle, almost a mile. And I don't know the outcome of that either, and that was well before I got there. So there had always been rumors and talks of things like that, you know, in the missile field, not just at Ellsworth, but at Minot, at Maelstrom, at F.E. Warren in Wyoming. So it wasn't just this, and cattle mutilation. So that came also. That's where I first really got onto Linda Moulton Howe, because she was doing that working for a news agency out of Denver at the time. And she started investigating cattle mutilations. I saw two of them. And so I answered all these questions and everything I could. And then they had a little conversation between them two. And I was just supposed to sit there like I couldn't hear, you know, they were talking about me. And the commander sent me to the flight surgeon's office. He said, I want you to go to the flight surgeon's office because we got a doctor's going to take a look at you. Just check you and everything, make sure it's okay. I said, yes, sir. Okay. I mean, how are you going to say no? You're going to go, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So unusually so, they put me in a staff car and a driver took me over there. And of course, the OSI guys went also. The guy in the hat, mm-hmm. or the guy that had the hat, and that
Andrew Jack Doty.
Yeah, I can't remember if Doty went or not, but I think he did. Mm-hmm. Because he was put in charge of gathering and picking up our records, our medical records, mine and Michael Johnson's, and giving them to Jack Reed or the commander or making copies. I'm really not sure, but that was his function. Mm-hmm. So I get in this office, right, and there's two doctors and there's a nurse. And of course, I take off my uniform stuff, you know, my long johns and everything. Now I'm kind of chilled because it's cold outside. And with everything that happened, I'm still just trying to reel what this is. Just so unexpected, all of it, just not a normal thing for it to happen to a human being. And so the doctors came up to me and they checked my ears, eyes, nose, throat, my nostrils. I mean, just good Lord, everything. And they do something, then they go off and talk a little bit, and they come back and they do something else. And it's about the third trip that they tested my reflexes and, you know, looked at my fingers and hands. His doctor said he puts on a glove, and you know what that means when a doctor puts on a glove. Snaps that.
Get ready.
You know what I mean? I went.
Deep breath.
Man.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and the nurse is in there, and I'm, you know, I'm already not feeling this at all, you know. So he said, can you open your mouth for me? And I said, okay. Oh, yes, sir. Really? And that guy took his index finger, this one doctor. He wore glasses. Don't forget that. And man, he took that index finger and he went all through the inside of my mouth and my gums, pressing on everything around my gums, just like a oral surgeon would do, I guess, or a dentist would do. And he did that for a couple of minutes. And you know how that's just not a comfortable thing for a grown man to reach in your mouth and start grabbing your gums and, you know, and I mean, really feeling every nook and cranny in your mouth. I was like, and tasting vinyl too, you know?
Yeah.
He didn't tell me why he was doing it. He said he needed to do that. Nice. And when he was done, they talked for another second. And then they came back over and says, we need to take a couple of skin samples from you. And I just kind of stepped back. I said, what? He goes, yeah, well, you have some burns on you. I said, what do you mean? Well, he reached up and touched my forehead up here right above my right eye. It was real sensitive. I thought, well, that's weird. Sure enough, there was a burn up there. And then he picked up my hand, and on the back of my hand was burned. I didn't have a glove on that hand.
Right.
So he took two skin samples off the back of my hand, and he took one skin sample from up here. And all of them went into these two vials. The two from the hand went into one vial. The tool that he used to do it went in the vial with it, and it was corked and put on a little stainless plate tray. The same thing, and you know, with the forehead. He took skin sample from here. They put those little round Band-Aids on it. Or no, it wasn't a little strip Band-Aid or something that he put on it and put that in a vial, laid it on that tray and asked me a few more questions, checked my back and stuff, said, well, why don't you just go ahead and get dressed and you can go back over to commander's office. I said, yes, sir. So that whole process took probably an hour and 20 minutes with those two flight surgeons. Mm-hmm. Nurse never said a word. They never came back with any kind of report or anything, or you know, anything that I could hear, I never heard.
Were the mysterious guy with the hat, or were they present during your exam?
They had gone back to the commander's office. They knew when it was over, and I got back in that staff, that colonel's car, and they took me back to the SATAP building. And I got out, and they were right there at the door, so I couldn't go anywhere. I was being watched. Really watched, you know. And I went back into the commander's office and had to do the same reporting in. It was just so strange, man. The way in which they handle it. I guess it's so new to them too that they didn't really quite know how to handle it.
Yeah.
And so I went back in, reported back to Colonel Spraker, told him everything that he asked me. He says, "Is there anything else you want to tell me, or anything else you need?" And I said, "I really can't think of anything else." So he said, "Well, you're going to have to write, you got to write this down. You got to do a report." And I said, "Well, I knew that, you know." Mm-hmm. I said, "Yes, sir." So they gave me one of these Skillcraft pens right here, just like number two. I think that's what that's called. Skillcraft pen, government issue pen. Put me in a little briefing office next to his office there. Nobody left. They are all still sitting out there. Put me in there, closed the door behind me. And I sat there for the next hour and 30 minutes writing a 3-page report that was in triplicate, because back then we didn't have computers and it had carbon copy on the back of the paper. And I don't know the form, but it was just a standard report, security police report form. And so I finished that and I initialed it and everything, dated it and signed it. And I came back out and I put it on his desk and he read it. Looked at it, went through all 3 pages, made sure it was complete. He said, "All right." And then that Jack Reed walked over to him, and he wasn't far away anyway, just 3 or 4 feet away in a chair. And he walked over and he had some papers in his hand. And it was a non-disclosure order. Wasn't an agreement. It was a damn order, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you're not allowed to speak about this to anyone, up to and including who you're married to, or neighbors. He said, you do not discuss any of this at any point with any people in the media, with any newspaper people. I mean, they cover all the bases. There's nothing left out. They do know how to do that.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.